Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as a bit of a tour of the battle space of the war for the free world, the war we are very much engaged in. And one of the leading combatants in this war, I believe, is our first guest, Patrick Caddell, a well-known pollster, political analyst, commentator at Fox News and elsewhere, and savant on what is going on that matters in this this very crucial political season. Pat, I wanted to get your take first and foremost on the debate last night between Mitt Romney and President Obama in Denver.
Well, I thought that I don't think it surprised anybody to watch because Governor Romney clobbered President Obama. I mean, it's just that simple. The President, and you know, Obama has spent $200-300 million attacking Romney for everything from being a tax cheat to not paying his taxes to not caring about people to letting people die, whatever that it is. They have done, and he didn't make one of those charges in the camp in the debate. So, it was kind of an anomaly. I thought
striking. The content seemed to me to be fairly substantive throughout. I credit Jim Lehrer. I wonder if you have any thoughts on that. The format lent itself to an actual debate on the substance of domestic policy, and was refreshing in that respect, as opposed to what we've often seen of sort of gotcha questions from the journalists posing as moderators.
No, it was. I thought he allowed them to debate, and I thought it was as substantive a debate as I've seen in years. And look, Romney did two things. I mean, it's clear from the polls, and this may be one of the more, I clearly think, more decisive debates, just looking at the CBS data of uncommitted voters, which is that who had real skepticism about Romney caring about them, and which I think is a very real problem for Romney, has been. And, he doubled the number of people. He went up to 53% from 30 who thought he cared about people. And I just saw it on leadership. I think he was 78 to 12 thought he was a decisive leader. So that's what you need to be able to do.
Yeah, definitely swinging votes. Pat, one of the things that you have been really leading on for quite some time, and again, our guest is Patrick Caddell, nationally recognized pollster and political analyst and consultant, is the importance of national security. And this has been almost entirely absent. I guess there were one or two passing mentions of it last night.
Yeah, there was. And by the way, because it was raised by Governor Romney, raised it. And it was interesting that I was looking at CNN last night on their rerun of the debate, had uncommitted voters in Colorado doing one of those dial groups. And in both cases where Romney talked about where the president went after cutting, saying that he's going to spend too much money on military, did not get a positive response. Romney's thing about defending America, America being strong, and particularly in his clothes, you could see the dial move. I mean, they really moved the dial. So I've said all along, I think it's an important issue.
Well, you have, and you've also been doing polling with John McLaughlin that actually, I think, makes this point in very telling terms. We are going to have a debate on this subject, the last of the three debates, of course. This was not the focus of it last night. But, Patrick, give us a sense of how, if you were advising the Romney campaign, you would recommend they proceed with respect to engaging on this set of issues, especially in the wake of what happened in Libya and Egypt and elsewhere around the world in the past couple of weeks.
I think they should have already engaged this issue. I mean, they pulled their horns in immediately after the mainstream media attacked Romney for actually saying the correct thing. But, we argue about the timing being right or not. When he said about them, the embassy, about the apology and about the president, he is this is a president who was not attending you know, national security briefings. I mean, his daily briefing until he got caught. Now he goes to them. He didn't even go to one the morning after because he was in Las Vegas raising campaign money after the burning of the consulate, you know, and the murder of our ambassador and the other three Americans. It is his, and, you know, when despite the mainstream media's effort to, you know, suppress, as I call it, just flat-out suppress news about the rioting around the world against the United States and all this, and also this very, very phony narrative, but even the New York Times finally has had to acknowledge, this fraudulent narrative that the White House promoted was because only of this film. When they had intelligence to the contrary and news to the contrary, which proves to us, proves to me, I mean, it doesn't surprise me, given the people who are in the White House, but, you know, that they're prepared fully to, you know, to use national defense, to sacrifice national defense, if you will, I'll say it even harsher, to sacrifice the security of the United States if necessary in, to promote the reelection of Barack Obama, which apparently is more important than the country.
A chilling thought. You really dissected this whole question of the role that the American media is playing in this campaign, not as the objective observers and equal opportunity critics and sort of the check and balance that I think the framers of the Constitution envisioned for a free press, but really as partisans on behalf of President Obama in a very important address that you provided recently at an Accuracy in Media event. You said, quote, "We are at the most dangerous time in our political history in terms of the balance of power in the role of that the media plays in whether we maintain a free democracy or not," unquote. Would you drill down on that for a moment?
Well, it's just, look, my argument is the First Amendment. The reason that we have a First Amendment is not because the founding fathers loved the press. They hated the press. But they recognized, as Jefferson so eloquently said, that there could not be a free America without a free press to protect the people from the government. And when, you know, and if that is why the press is the only institution that does not have checks and balances against it, and like the very carefully set up constitutional structure we have for institutions. And it was done that way because the idea is that the press should protect the people. That's their job, and to protect us from power. And when the press is for some time, you know, and there's always been bias in the press. In recent years, it's been greater. Since 2008, it has passed the line in terms of support. I like to say there's three campaign teams on the field right now. There's the Obama team, the Romney team, and then there's the mainstream press, which is the reps who are working, who are tackling sacking Romney at this quarterback. You know, tackling his players, blocking them, serving as part of it. That's greater than anything we've ever seen. We've never seen the press so outright in service of another candidacy, right down to how they use their polls, how they've been doing them. And monolithically so, to promote the narrative that Romney was a dead man. And by with polls that no one in their right mind is a fair-minded pollster should be putting out with the kinds of samples they have, in my opinion.
Now, Pat, we've only got a minute left, but I just do want to drill down on that.
The last point. Last point is what they've been doing about hiding, but worse than something they've never done, is now they've decided what truth the American people should know and what should be suppressed. Their coverage of what happened in Libya and in Egypt and around the world has been unbelievable, and it has been to suppress stories that would undermine the narrative of the Obama administration about their suppressing bin Laden and killing bin Laden and suppressing al-Qaeda. That's a frightening thing. They've now decided they won't tell the American people what's going on.
And the irony of all this, of course, is that part of what is going on, of course, is an effort to suppress freedom of expression, which one would think the press has as much of a stake in coming out right as any of us. It is, unfortunately, not the administration's view.
Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, they will not allow any criticism. They won't use the words Muslim extremists or Islamic terrorists. And will suppress speech. They have been doing this for some time. It is scary that we have entered territory we've never entered before, and we are sliding a slippery slope between something between Baghdad Bob and Newspeak from 1984, Orwell's 1984.
Wow, a chilling thought. Patrick Cadell, we have to let you go. Thank you for your continuing service to our country. Of course, you were a pollster for President Carter. We appreciate you being with us today, and keep up the good work, sir. Next up, Dr. Mark Schneider will talk about Russian arms control violations and U.S. unilateral disarmament. Straight ahead.
I want to know what you think. Leave your comments at 1-800-332-7131.
This hurricane season, coastal residents in the Southeast and the Gulf states are urged to prepare for the uncertain conditions they may encounter in the aftermath of a major storm and make their annual contingency plans. In addition to other emergency essentials, the American Red Cross and the U.S. Department of Homeland Security recommend residents keep a diversified emergency wallet that includes cash and traveler's checks. American Express traveler's checks provide an extra measure of financial safety and security. Keeping traveler's checks and a supply of cash in small bills offers storm victims payment options to make necessary purchases. Traveler's checks never expire, providing a secure payment method whenever emergencies occur, this year and in the future. Unlike cash, they're refundable if lost or stolen. American Express traveler's checks are available at banks, credit unions, and American Express travel service locations across the Gulf Coast and Southeast regions. For more information, please visit www.americanexpress.com/travelerschecks.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit shariathethreat.com. Or order your copy of Sharia, The Threat to America at Amazon.com.
Experts say there's no shortage of crude oil.
There really is no shortage of oil at the moment.
So why do gasoline prices keep going up?
There's all this fear that's out there, and that really goes a long way to making prices go up.
And home prices seem to be headed even lower.
We really aren't seeing any markets that are showing any sustained recovery at this point.
Now more than ever, is this a timeout or a double dip?
It could halt the economy's recovery in its tracks.
1260 WR. RC, new choice, intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are joined by a true American hero, almost entirely unsung. He has worked for decades in the United States government. Now is associated with a marvelous organization, the National Institute for Public Policy, where he serves as a senior analyst. But our guest, Dr. Mark Schneider, is truly one of the country's preeminent authorities on some of the most sensitive and important, but again, altogether underreported issues of our time, specifically matters involving nuclear deterrence and security related thereto. I had the privilege of working with Dr. Schneider many, many years ago in the Defense Department. He went on to a number of other roles and capacities, earning in the process numerous decorations from the Secretary of Defense. And it's a great pleasure to have him with us to talk about some of the research that he's been doing at the National Institute for Public Policy on Russian arms control violations. And before we jump into that, Mark, first of all, let me say welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. It's great to have you with us.
Well, thank you very much for that wonderful, if undeserved, introduction.
Well, it's wholly inadequate given your tremendous contributions. But let me just ask you, if before we drill down on some of the most recent
instances you've documented in a new paper for the NIPP of Russian violations in connection with the New START treaty. Talk to us a little bit about, Dr. Schneider, what has happened over the years in this space, the Soviet Union before, now Russia, and its attitude towards compliance with various arms control obligations.
Well, if I had to describe the Soviet and Russian attitude toward arms control compliance, I don't think there's really much difference between the two. It would be a compliance to the extent convenient. There's a pattern of arms control violations going back to the 1970s, where they simply ignore literally black and white constraints on their capability. When it proves inconvenient to what they want to do. And that is one of the biggest problems that we have always had in the arms control arena. A tough approach to negotiating arms control constraints with Russia doesn't mean very much if there's no compliance. And the lack of compliance by the Russians is rather blatant. I've documented this in the monograph I did on New START, which is called New START, Anatomy of a Failed Negotiation, which is on the NIPP website, and it's free. There's a whole chapter 4, which deals with literally a 30-40-year pattern of Russian violations of all of the arms control treaties. And I expect that very much to continue, and it has a lot of implications for the supposed Obama administration agenda. And I say supposed because I don't see very much follow-through on this, but they're talking about trying to limit tactical nuclear weapons in the next phase and going to lower strategic numbers and moving toward nuclear zero. That is extraordinarily dangerous unless you have complete compliance with existing arms control obligations, which you certainly do not.
Let me ask you about one particularly egregious example of this. Mark Schneider, again, is our guest now with the National Institute for Public Policy. Back when we were both in the Pentagon in the Reagan administration, Mark, I remember you staffing very effectively an analysis of the extent to which the Soviet Union was systematically violating the anti-ballistic missile treaty so as to give rise to a circumstance in which we had essentially no missile defense and they had quite a comprehensive territorial defense. As an example of a strategically significant and deliberate act of cheating, it's hard for me to imagine that there's something that tops that. But let's talk a little bit about the New START treaty, and this is the subject of a new paper you've just produced entitled Russian Violations of Its Arms Control Obligations. And give us a sense of what's happening as we speak in this space, Mark Schneider.
Well, the biggest problem right now clearly is with the INF treaty. While the administration talks about using things like social media to verify arms control agreements, it has completely ignored what amounts to a substantial amount of Russian press. I mean, major Russian publications, major Russian journalists reporting activity, which, if true, would unquestionably be a violation of the INF treaty, in a sense, is as big a violation as we saw with the chemical and biological weapons areas. They are deploying, or at least they're reportedly deploying, systems, cruise missiles that have 2, 3, 4 times the range that's permitted under the INF treaty, systems that can cover most of Europe. And it's not one issue, it's a whole series of issues. And this is something that I outline in my recent publications relating to compliance in some detail.
Mark Schneider, you also describe evidence that the Russians have been testing nuclear weapons, something, of course, we have not done since 1992. give us a flavor of kind of the overall condition, if you would, of the Russian nuclear arsenal at this point, vis-a-vis that of the deterrent forces of the United States.
Well, we are struggling to maintain an aging and rather decrepit nuclear arsenal, while they are completely modernizing both their delivery vehicles and their nuclear weapons. There is an enormous amount of literature in the Russian press about this. Some of their most senior leaders have stated publicly on more than one occasion that they are developing and deploying new types of nuclear weapons, exactly the opposite of what we are doing. There are numerous reports in the Russian media about what's called hydronuclear testing, which is very low-yield nuclear testing, but testing that can have significant impact on both the safety and the reliability of nuclear weapons, that this is going on in Russia. There are several declassified CIA reports on this subject, unfortunately highly redacted, about 98% is just blacked out, but the CIA did not, reports tens of pages on non-existent issues. So I think it's absolutely clear that they are doing nuclear testing. The commission, the Strategic Commission report in 2009 said they were apparently doing hydronuclear testing, and this has tremendous impact on the reliability and their ability to modernize their nuclear deterrent. And they're doing some very advanced nuclear designs. I mean, an individual by the name of Viktor Mikhailov, who was atomic energy minister in the 1990s and head of the Sarov nuclear weapons laboratory until he retired and then recently died within the last decade, talked about the development of extremely capable Earth penetrator nuclear weapons with low collateral damage warheads. This is something that we're not doing at all. We are doing no modernization. The Obama administration has prohibited any modernization of our nuclear stockpile in a manner that enhances capability, while the Russians are doing exactly that.
Yeah. Mark Schneider, we have to leave it at this, unfortunately. I wanted to address with you as well the strategic nuclear exercises that the Russians have been mounting in very much the same way they did during the Cold War, in violating our airspace, threatening our people and our country, needless to say. These are the sorts of issues that you have followed with extraordinary professionalism over your entire career in the United States government and now with the National Institute of Public Policy. We are deeply appreciative of all that work, Mark, and we hope that you'll come back to us with updates as these very, very momentous issues continue to evolve to, I'm afraid, our extreme detriment. Thank you, Mark Schneider, for joining us as always. Next up, we'll be speaking with Matt Boyle of the Daily Caller about the intensifying drug war. Are we winning? Straight ahead.
To SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, NBA forward Kevin Durant from the Oklahoma City Thunder. Here with Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck to remind you to get moving every day.
Because when you get moving an hour a day,
you'll have more energy to do the things you like to do.
And that's a slam dunk.
Whether you like to shoot hoops like me, skateboard, ride a bike,
or dance on your roof, just move it your way.
For an hour a day. Because moving every day puts you on the offense towards a stronger you.
And that makes you part of a winning team.
I couldn't have said it better myself, Bugs.
So be a player.
Be a player.
Get up, play, and move it your way. Check out how to be a player at letsmove.gov.
Head online to get tips on great ways to get moving every day.
You said it. At www.letsmove.gov. Let's hear that one more time, Doc. That's www.letsmove.gov. A message from the Ad Council and HHS.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Mitt Romney did what he needed to do during his debate with Barack Obama in Denver last night. That's not simply because the Republican candidate was focused, articulate, and presentable. By contrast, the president was flat, defensive, and appeared unable to go toe-to-toe with his rival. The moderator, Jim Blair of PBS, deserves credit, too. There were none of the journalist's seemingly self-promoting and intrusive gotcha questions so common in past presidential debates. Blair allowed the candidates to go at it, guiding the conversation without getting in the way. A format that lets the presidential contenders actually debate one another may be a novel concept for American politics, but it should be used much more often if the purpose is to inform the voters and give them a reason to vote. This is Frank Gaffney with a Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedomradio.com.
In 1966 in Anchorage, Alaska, a talented child was born. He would go on to be one out of only 11 Alaskans to make it to the major leagues. The odds of him striking out more than 3,000 hitters? 1 in 33 million. The odds of this pitcher being selected to the Major League Baseball All-Star Game 6 times? 1 in 48 million. The odds of this fast-balling philanthropist winning the World Series 3 times? 1 in 3 million. The odds of this man having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 110. Hi, I'm Kurt Schilling. Learn the signs of autism at autismspeaks.org. Autism is getting closer to home. From 1 in 5,000 only 20 years ago, today 1 in 110 children are diagnosed. Early diagnosis can make a lifetime of difference. Autism Speaks. It's time to listen. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement. And how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Effney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're joined by Matt Boyle. He is a reporter with a splendid new news organization known as The Daily Caller. Relatively new, I should say. It's been making considerable waves in Washington for about 2 years now, I guess. And Matt, you've been with it since January of 2011. You have been covering intensively, I know, matters involving the sort of drug trafficking and the fast and furious gun walking, whatever you want to call it, caper, and the political repercussions of it. And I wanted to sort of start with an overview assessment, if I could, of how you see this so-called war on drugs being waged at the moment. Are we winning? Are we losing? Are we making sort of tactical successes here and there, but losing the war? What's your reading on it overall at the moment?
Well, I mean, I don't think anybody would say that we're winning the war on drugs or the war on the drug cartels. I mean, the drug cartels are very powerful criminal enterprise organizations, and you have to treat them as such. You can't treat them as just gangs or groups of rogue operatives or anything like that. I mean, these are powerful, almost terrorist organizations, and right now I don't think we're treating them as such, so that's why we're not winning.
You recently reported on the takedown of a character by the name of El Diego, Jose Antonio Acosta Hernandez. Again, we get reports of these sorts of things from time to time, and it's never quite clear whether that's a decisive blow to, as you say, these very formidable criminal enterprises, or whether, one cartel ringleader, drug lord, whatever you want to call him, is readily replaced by another. What's your sense, again, of the implications of this particular success? And I gather there's been another one involving a senior Los Zetas cartel boss known as El Taliban, Ivan Velasquez Caballero.
Well, you can take out the head of the organization, but they're just going to replace it with somebody else. It's just like Al-Qaeda. You know, you take out bin Laden, it doesn't mean Al-Qaeda's over. It's pretty clear that the left wing in the Democratic Party, the president, want to believe that that the war on terror is over because bin Laden, is dead. But pretty clear it isn't. I mean, what's going on in the Middle East right now, we see that Al-Qaeda was behind the attacks in Libya. Same thing goes for the drug cartels. You can take out the leader of the drug cartel, you can take out the guy who's ordering the hits, but just because you take him out, the same organizational structure, the same, organized crime or terrorist organization structure exists there, and just somebody else is going to step up and call the shots, and that person might be even more brutal than the last person who was there. And the thing is that what's really interesting about the captures of these high-ranking people is that, at least in the instance of El Diago, who ran the hitman squad, basically, for the Juarez cartel, which is just south of El Paso in Texas, is that when he was captured, he was found with Operation Fast and Furious weapons on his person. He's the head of the cartel, and he's got weapons from our government in his hands.
Yeah. Let's segue from, this sort of front lines of this war on drugs to that story. You've been following it closely, Matt Boyle, at The Daily Caller. We had in the past 10 days or so a report by the Inspector General of the Department of Justice presented to the Government Reform Committee in the House. It seemed to suggest that this was basically a problem that had predated the arrival of the Obama administration, that the Bush administration had been doing some of this gun walking as well, and in both cases there had been inadequate oversight by the ATF, I guess it was, and of course by the U.S. Attorney's Office, and there was no evidence, according to this report, that the Attorney General was somehow knowledgeable or culpable in this. What's your read on where the truth lies here?
Well, the report, what it does is it pretty clearly lays out that that senior officials in the Department of Justice, which, by the way, the Attorney General has claimed on numerous occasions before Congress in testimony that the Justice Department in Washington didn't know. Well, the Inspector General has come out and proven that the Justice Department did know, and as high as the number 2 and 3 in the Justice Department knew. So we know that in the day that this report came out, Jason Weinstein, who was Deputy Assistant Attorney General in Washington, resigned. He was number four in the Justice Department. The IG report proved that Lanny Brewer, who is the head of the Justice Department's criminal division, essentially the number 3 in the Justice Department, knew just as much as what caused Mr. Weinstein to resign. He still works for the United States taxpayers. Holder hasn't held him accountable. Then acting Deputy Attorney General, the number 2 in the Justice Department, was well aware that Fast and Furious weapons were used to kill Brian Terry, a Border Patrol agent, the night that he was murdered back in late 2010, December 2010. At this point, his testimony to the IG and to Congress is that he can't recall whether he told Holder about it before Holder was made publicly aware by press reports. So the point is that at this point in time, it's very hard to believe that Holder didn't know. And the IG has actually said that before Congress. He's actually, I can't remember the exact quote off the top of my head, but he said something like it's unfathomable that the Attorney General was unaware of this when everybody who works for him was. So basically what's happened here is that there's a culture of plausible deniability that's been created around Holder. At the same time, What this report does also is it proves that everybody's been right all along on this, is that this was a major Justice Department initiative. This was not just some local thing that was started in Phoenix. So, Matt Boyle,
how does that fit with the question of whether or not everybody did it? That the Bush administration had if not identical, very similar kind of program going on. So there was nothing particularly wrong or ill conceived about the Fast and Furious operation under the Obama administration.
Yeah, the Bush administration had a similar, smaller scale, less dangerous program going on. What they had was Operation Wide Receiver, and once again, the IG report confirms this, is that Operation Wide Receiver was it was a failure. Nobody's going to defend it, but what it was is it was a controlled delivery operation where they worked with Mexican law enforcement. In Fast and Furious, the Obama administration kept Mexico in the dark. The Bush administration didn't. And the other thing is that in Wide Receiver, it wasn't something that was run by the Washington Justice Department officials. Wide Receiver was done by the local officials in ATF in Phoenix. And Fast and Furious was done, it was put in play by the local officials in Phoenix, but the people in Washington were well aware of everything that was going on, and they were, micromanaging things.
Yeah. Is it your estimation that there was, in fact, a larger purpose behind this operation as far as the Washington folks were concerned, having to do with trying to create conditions for advancing an arms, or I should say gun control agenda?
Well, at this point, we know that they used it to put a gun control regulation into place. There's a new regulation that was put in place in 2011 that's called the Multiple Long Gun Sales Reporting Rule. It means in border states. So in the four border states, if you buy multiple long guns, you have to there's a new regulation for that that was used by ATF used Fast and Furious to put into place. We have the emails back and forth between, mid-level to senior-level ATF officials that show that they were planning to push gun control with this, and they were asking the agents on the ground while this was going on for the statistics about when and where these weapons were showing up, so that they could go and use it to go after demand letter 3, which is what they used to put this gun control. We know they did it. The question is whether or not that was the motivation behind the senior Justice Department officials. Right now, there's not a ton of evidence to support it, but there's no other theory that makes sense with the evidence that we know.
Yeah, the evidence leads to that and leads Paul Ryan, among others, to call for the Attorney General's resignation. It certainly seems overdue as far as I'm concerned and can't come soon enough. Matt Boyle, we have to leave it at that. Thank you for the superb reporting that you're doing at the Daily Caller, for joining us from time to time to talk about it, and keep up the good work. We look forward to talking with you again very soon. Next up, we've got Corey Shockey. She'll give us her sense of what the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff is up to on behalf of President Obama's political agenda. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Do you see that doggy in the shelter?
Hi, I'm Buddy, the adorable puppy you adopted from the Humane Society.
Meow. I'm Whiskers, a fluffy kitty, just waiting for someone to love me.
When you adopt a pet, we hope your new furry friend will become a cherished member of your family. And as Buddy and Whiskers will tell you, the key to success is following the rules to love by.
Woof, that's right. Please give me food, water, and exercise every day. To stay healthy, I need the same kind of things you need.
Talk to me. I like hearing your voice.
You're my best friend. Please don't stay mad at me or lock me up as punishment. Remember, I'm probably going to live 10 to 15 years, so take care of me when I get old.
One day you'll need someone to take care of you, too.
A message from the Montgomery County Humane Society. Visit www.mchumane.org for the complete rules to love by.
Be your best friend for life.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real special forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its special forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home was built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
In Washington, Hugh Hewitt has the diagnosis.
They don't understand the need for speed.
Oh, we'll get to it. Don't worry. We'll get it done. Open amendment process, blah, 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 blah.
Not in the least bit clued in to the sense of urgency, but I don't think the Beltway is.
I'm just beginning to think it is a Beltway disease.
Kind of an invisible wall separates them from what the people think.
The Hugh Hewitt Show, weeknights from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone. At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there. So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill,
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home, or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org.
Even if it's just everyday stuff,
like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really? What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined by Corey Shockey. She is a research fellow at the Hoover Institution, the author of, among other things, Managing American Hegemony, Essays on Power in a Time of Dominance. A very serious thinker, analyst, and communicator on the national security issues of our time, and someone we always welcome back to our microphones. Great to have you with us, Corey.
Such a pleasure to be with you, Frank.
Thanks. Listen, let's start with sort of your takeaway from last night's debate. There's a lot of commenting to the effect that Obama did not fare well. Naturally, the national security subjects were not much in focus, really received only sort of passing mention by both the president and his challenger. From what you saw of the debate and specifically the comments that were made on the national security topics, what is, in your view, the most important takeaway?
For me, the most important takeaway was the way that Governor Romney talked about the debt not simply as a money problem, but as a moral problem. I think that's such an important context for the fact that we are going to impose on our children a much narrower range of choice and a much less secure country if we don't fix this problem. I was so impressed with that.
He touched on, at several points, including, of course, in his closing comment, the importance of national defense to both our economic well-being and obviously to our physical security. Were you surprised
at the emphasis he's placed on it? And how did you think President Obama addressed this subject to the extent he did, specifically with respect to his comment that the military doesn't want the $2 trillion he said that, that Romney was going to
so
give them?
I'm so glad you noticed that. I was not surprised that Governor Romney emphasized the importance of a strong American military and the role that that plays in a broader global understanding of American power, because he's been quite consistent about this throughout his candidacy. I was surprised at the ease with which the president politicized the American military for an election advantage, and it was unseemly. To me, the president's comments in his Charlotte acceptance speech that Governor Romney was trying to force money and weapons on the military that the Joint Chiefs of Staff didn't want was unseemly, and his comments last night that the military, as though the entire 1.2 million servicemen and women in the force had one view on this important issue, seemed to me worthy of being rebutted by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, for example, who has cast himself as the arbiter of the civil-military line. The president was way past the boundary of using our military for political purposes last night.
You know, the sort of most egregious manifestation of this, and I completely agree with you, Corey Shockey, is that he actually had them standing around him the old cigar store Indians when he was announcing these cuts, really forcing them to sort of associate themselves with them, or at least seem to convey the impression that they were good with them. Talk to us a little bit about the role that General Dempsey has been playing. He certainly has, as you say, been very critical of those who, for example, are simply exercising their right to free speech, which is very much, I'm afraid, in jeopardy at the moment. Would seemingly be something that a guy who swore an oath to defend and uphold the Constitution of the United States would be, you know, lining up on the other side.
I felt uncomfortable about two recent actions General Dempsey took in this regard. First, him calling the Florida pastor who he considered important in fanning the flames of Muslim outrage about the video that was released. It may be appropriate for the Secretary of State or someone close to the president to call an American citizen, to reach out to an American citizen and to ask them not to exercise their First Amendment rights for the broader good of the country. But it's creepy to have the military do that. That, to me, felt really uncomfortable that General Dempsey was the person calling that pastor in Florida. And then the second recent example that made me uncomfortable was General Dempsey's comment about retired veterans being engaged in the bruising rough and tumble of American political life. When people are in uniform, there are some pretty clear boundaries to what is appropriate behavior. And part of General Dempsey's certainly right that part of the reason Americans so admire our own military is because they police themselves on this. But retired veterans do not give up for the entirety of their life their First Amendment rights and their activism for what they believe is good for the country. We will be a poorer political community if General Dempsey's standard takes hold.
I could not agree with you more, Corey Shockey. Again, our guest is, among other things, a research fellow at the Hoover Institution. She is also the Bradley Professor of International Security Studies at West Point, the U.S. Military Academy there, and has served in a number of very senior capacities in the national security firmament of our government, and brings considerable expertise on these matters, including from her time in the Joint Chiefs of Staff's organization, where she worked in strategy and policy directorate a while back. Corey, I think this is such a critical point, and it's not really well understood. We take for granted the subordinate role of the military to civilian authority. I must tell you, I'm a little uneasy about even having the Secretary of State or some other person close to the president calling and telling American citizens, you know, that they should refrain from exercising their First Amendment rights. But I certainly agree with you about these among other examples of General Dempsey's injecting himself in a way that that seems most inappropriate. I know people can read more of your thoughts on this subject at your blog posting at Shadow Government, Foreign Policy Magazine's blog. Let me ask you about something else, Corey, because you've done a wonderful analysis on your blog of the Obama record as part of your essay entitled Taking the Easier Path to a Worse Place. And we won't have time to do justice to all of this, but I just would mention several of the things that you highlighted in that that critical analysis. That the president has written off Iraq, he has under-resourced Afghanistan, he has abdicated responsibility regarding budgets, including sequestration. And he claims, of course, that he has put al-Qaeda on the path to defeat. And yet there's much evidence that even if the problem were exclusively, as he insists, al-Qaeda, that path is nowhere near defeat. And indeed, they and others who adhere to this sort of Sharia supremacist agenda are very much on the march. In anticipating the debate that's yet to come at the I believe it's the 22nd of the month, give us a flavor of how you see the contrast being teed up between the president's record and vision and that of Mitt Romney.
I agree with the cast of your description very strongly, Frank. The president is deeply invested in a view of the Middle East that suggests that we don't have a problem about violent extremism. We only have an al-Qaeda problem. Moreover, we have largely solved the al-Qaeda problem because, after all, has he mentioned that he killed Osama bin Laden? And therefore, we can disengage from the Middle East, wind down the war in Afghanistan, and shift our attention to the much more interesting Pacific. And that's not true in any of its major elements. We do not just have an al-Qaeda problem. We have a problem about the center of gravity of thought in the Muslim Middle East and shaping it in a way that is tolerant, encouraging the engagement of broader civil society and voices that balance either cultural or religious conservatism and intolerance in those societies. Second, al-Qaeda is, if you simply look at the case of Iraq, the al-Qaeda resurgence that has resulted from our withdrawal from Iraq and our political disengagement from Iraq has actually been extraordinarily bad for that country and extraordinarily bad for American security.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.